For the first time, the Department of Defense is blocking the path to citizenship for immigrants serving in the U.S. military. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Serving your country in the armed forces may be the ultimate display of citizen loyalty, but in America, you don't actually have to be a citizen to enlist. Until recently, many immigrants found military service to be a faster track to citizenship, but now the New York Times reports that process is experiencing serious delays. To understand what the military offers those who serve, the Texas Standard's David Brown talked with Margaret Stock, a retired Air Reserve Lieutenant Colonel and lawyer representing former servicemen suing the U.S. government for breaking its path to citizenship promise.
It seems like this should be a pretty straightforward issue, but clearly it's not. What promises of citizenship does one get when signing up for the military?
Well, immigrants have been joining the Army since 1775, and they've been earning citizenship through military service. It's a long tradition. People are told when they enlist that they can apply immediately for naturalization, and in fact, there's a law that allows people serving during wartime to apply for naturalization after one day of honorable service in the reserve or on active duty.
Wow. But this isn't a guarantee of citizenship. It's sort of a more fast track.
Well, they have to apply for it. They must fill out the form and they must qualify for citizenship. But this is the first time in history that the Department of Defense has ordered a complete halt to the naturalization of military service members. And that's apparently what's happened.
Well, why? Why is there this halt in the naturalization process?
It's not clear. You'd have to ask the Department of Defense. It's unprecedented and it's harming many of the people who join the military. In fact, in their contracts, it says they're required to apply for citizenship as soon as they are able to do that. And they believed in good faith that the government would process their applications, but the government is no longer processing their applications in good faith.
Is this because maybe they're overwhelmed by the numbers of people who are non-citizens who are serving in the military these days? Or do you suspect something else is going on?
No, apparently the Department of Defense doesn't like the law that Congress passed and recently noticed that reservists are allowed to naturalize after one day of service. I'm told the Department of Defense doesn't think that's a good idea, and they called a halt to the applications because they want to change the law.
That's remarkable. Does the Department of Defense admit that that's what's going on here, or are they mum on the subject?
Well, I haven't heard directly from anybody at DOD about it, but I do have an email from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services that says the Department of Defense directed them not to allow any reservists to naturalize.
Is it true that a non-citizen member of the military can nonetheless be buried in Arlington Cemetery if killed in action, but may not be guaranteed citizenship status and all the benefits that accrue there?
Yes, that's correct.
Does that seem somewhat inconsistent to you?
Well, there are many inconsistencies in the law. I'll give you another example. They can get citizenship automatically if they die in combat, but they can be denied it for applying for it when they're alive.
So what's your role in all of this? As an attorney, what are you trying to do now?
Well, I'm trying to make members of Congress and senators aware that the Department of Defense has decided not to follow the law. I'm trying to make the military members affected aware of it.
Why does this matter so much to you? You didn't have to go through this process yourself, did you?
I didn't. My family's been in the country since before the Revolutionary War. But I served in the military for 28 years, and I served alongside immigrants who have put their lives on the line for America. And America's a nation of immigrants. If you read the Declaration of Independence, one of our grievances against King George was that he was stopping naturalizations of immigrants to our shores. The United States military has won every war because of immigrants. I mean, it's if you know military history, you know, 20% of the army in World War I was made up of immigrants. It's shameful, and it's a rejection of our history to treat immigrants who are serving in the manner that we're treating them right now. They put their lives on the line to defend the United States of America, and it's not even their country yet. And now we're stalling their citizenship applications and refusing to let them become citizens. It's shameful.
That was the Texas Standard's David Brown and attorney Margaret Stock. Turning now to North Texas, where a century ago, West Dallas was a poor, mostly white, unincorporated home for folks on the edge of society. Decades later, black families moved in, then Latinos. Poverty connects them. But that's starting to change. Glitzy apartments and tougher housing standards are forcing out hundreds of families. As KERA's Courtney Collins reports, many of them have no place to go.
Driving from downtown to West Dallas got a whole lot grander 5 years ago. A majestic white arch, 400 feet tall, makes the Margaret Hunt Hill Bridge a landmark that defines a city. The bridge is sleek and fast. You zip across the Trinity with the Dallas skyline in your rearview, and dead ahead, a restaurant mecca. Spiced lamb skewers, duck fat fried rice, a shop that sells nothing but cake. Trinity Groves is a collection of more than a dozen restaurants under one long roof. The open-air patios are mobbed every weekend. Venture a little deeper into the neighborhood, past the valet stands and happy hour crowd, and the scene shifts. In front of small, weathered homes, folks watch the world from their front porches. You can hear the birds, maybe an ice cream truck.
You don't have to be rich. You know, a home can be whatever you make it. You know, really, sit out in the front or cook in the back. You know, I just love it.
Longtime resident Ronnie Mestis says it's the same West Dallas that's been here for generations, before a bridge made it easy for the rest of North Texas to find. To understand this part of the neighborhood, you have to go back in time, all the way to the Great Depression.
It was unincorporated. Most of the streets were unpaved. It did not have sewers. It did not have, in many places, running water.
Doug Swanson wears a lot of hats. Professor, novelist, former reporter for the Dallas Morning News. He also wrote the definitive book on Benny Binion, the Dallas racketeer who started the World Series of Poker. When Binion needed a bad guy, he'd recruit in West Dallas.
I mean, they were coming in from the countryside, and they didn't have a place to go. So that's where they ended up, and it was a very fertile ground for criminal activity because of that.
You may have heard of at least a few of those criminals.
Well, I'm Miss Bonnie Parker, and this here's Mr. Clyde Barrow. We rob banks.
Back then, lawbreaking paid well, and real jobs were hard to come by. So Swanson says some folks turned to crime in desperation. The Barrow Gang may have been the most notorious West Dallas outlaws. They weren't the only ones.
That's the way it happened with a lot of people. There was too much money in crime and not enough money in more legitimate pursuits.
Then came World War II, and the North Texas economy perked up. People found work, often with defense contractors. And Swanson says the swirling crime scene calmed down.
I think it was the economy elsewhere that helped pull people out of West Dallas. Unfortunately, West Dallas still got left behind.
This was, after all, the part of town known as the Devil's Back Door. The city finally annexed West Dallas in 1954. Then came a massive housing project known for brutal living conditions and nicknamed the Monument to Poverty. The biggest monument there might have been a massive plant that recycled old car batteries. It was an economic magnet, drawing Latino workers and their families. And it was an environmental nightmare.
At its prime, RSR pumped more than 269 tons of lead particles into the West Dallas air.
Lead leached into the air, water, and soil, poisoning children for decades. After the plant closed, nonprofits and community leaders tried to bring real change to West Dallas. Regina Nippert helped redesign affordable housing.
My piece was really helping the local community to give voice to what it wanted. And that, at that time, was a pretty new idea, that people that lived in public housing would actually give voice to their own needs rather than someone coming in and saying, here, this is for you, take it or leave it.
She spent a lot of time in West Dallas in the 80s. Today, she runs the Bud Center at SMU. It helps nonprofits collaborate with schools in poor neighborhoods. She says West Dallas had, and still has, a rare and vibrant spirit.
There's not the sense of hopelessness that you sometimes see in other neighborhoods where you've got generational poverty. You've got a lot of people who came here with the intention of making a better life, and so there's still that kind of idea of things are going to get better.
Still, poverty persisted.
in some ways a rough place to be in, and otherwise it felt really full of promise, because there's, as an architect and a person who is aware of real estate, there's all this empty land.
Which brings us to the West Dallas of today.
Let's go back live to tonight's big event.
Chopper 5 live over the soon-to-be Margaret Hunt Hill Bridge, designed by Santiago Calatrava.
Those soaring white cables came with a price tag just south of $200 million. Critics ripped it as a bridge to nowhere. Regina Nippert says that didn't sit well with the 15,000 people who lived on the other side.
It's hurtful to hear people say that you live nowhere, or that you work nowhere, or you go to school, you teach nowhere.
The bridge was a straight shot that linked downtown Dallas to the community that had always been in its shadow. Doug Swanson, who spent so much time there 3 decades ago, says the lightning-fast building boom caught just about everybody off guard.
I mean, you could obviously see the change coming, and then the apartments started going up, and I thought, well, I'm really an old-timer now, because I never would have thought that you would see any development like that in West Dallas. And I also thought, you know, what's going to happen to the people who've been living here?
Ronnie Mestis is asking that question, too. The neighborhood leader says it's impossible to ignore the changing face of West Dallas.
I call it the wall. It's the financial wall, you know, those new apartments that are right there, you know, because it just looks like it just blocks out the whole neighborhood.
You can see that divide on Singleton Boulevard, just west of Sylvan. On one side, an empty lot where multi-story apartments and townhomes are taking shape. On the other, a rundown commercial strip. And behind that, hundreds of houses that date to the 1940s.
People been here all their lifetime, and it's hard for them to move out, you know?
Joe Garcia and 300 other families living in houses no longer up to city code are staring down a June 3rd move-out deadline. Next week, we'll look into what happens when folks used to paying $400 a month in rent suddenly find they have no place to go. For Fronteras, I'm Courtney Collins in Dallas.
Coming up on Fronteras, creating superheroes to fight issues in Native American communities.
You know, as a young man, as a warrior, I just felt like I should be doing something. Like, how can I combat this?
That story and the Árbol de la Vida art project, after this. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. In comics and graphic novels, Native American characters aren't usually very prominent. They're often sidekicks, or worse. But a new publisher focused exclusively on Native culture is changing that. Called Native Realities, the company just brought back the first all-Native superhero comic. KUNM's Megan Kemmerich reports.
John Proudstar remembers the first time he saw a Native American character in a comic. It was Thunderbird in the X-Men, and he was quickly killed off. Proudstar was 8 years old, and he was not happy.
And for years, I just lamented about it and said, you know, one day I'll bring him back.
I'll catch you, you blue devil, and when I do...
Thunderbird, wait!
Proudstar, who is Yaqui and Mexican, went one better. He created the first comic book to feature a whole team of Native American superheroes. Tribal Force debuted in 1996, but the publisher went out of business after just one issue.
For years, I kept trying to get another publisher, and nobody would touch us.
One reason? His main character was a sexual abuse survivor, not unlike an elementary school student he met working at a school in Tucson, who eventually took her own life.
You know, it broke my heart because I thought something big was going to happen from her death, and nothing did, and they swept it under the carpet.
And he found this problem was persistent in many Native communities.
I wanted to do something. You know, as a young man, as a warrior, I just felt like I should be doing something. Like, how can I combat this?
Over the years, various publishers approached him about Tribal Force.
They would always ask me, can you tone that down? Can you not talk about it? And I was like, no, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Then he found Lee Francis and Native Realities Press, which focuses on Native writers, artists, and game designers. Francis, from Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico, calls himself an indigenerd, and he wasn't put off by Proudstar's subject matter.
These are things that we face in our community, and we still need superheroes for this stuff. We need people that are going to be there to protect us, that are going to be there to help us out.
Native Realities also published Tales of the Mighty Code Talkers. That was edited by Kickapoo author Aragon Starr, best known for her comic book, Super Indian, and created with a slew of other Native writers and artists. I caught up with her at the first Indigenous Comic-Con. Native Realities produced the con last fall in Albuquerque.
Because we all knew that there were other tribes that were involved in the Code-Talking project besides the Navajo.
The book is designed like a graphic novel and is made up of historical vignettes.
Like, say, here's the story of two Creek soldiers in Sitka, Alaska versus the Japanese. We're trying to do this on multi-levels, A, to get the stories out there, but also to show language and culture.
Native Realities founder Lee Francis is working on the second Indigenous Comic-Con, slated for this fall. He'll publish more comics and games this year as well. Those will be available online, in schools, and at Native American community centers. Proudstar is working on more chapters of Tribal Force, happy he found an outlet that understands Native storytellers.
It's amazing because it's never existed before at this level, at the creative level and the support level, and Lee is so enthusiastic.
Ultimately, he hopes his work will prompt more people and tribal councils to address sexual abuse and suicide.
You know, it needs to happen. It has to happen. So hopefully Tribal Force is the first step in that.
The next chapter of Tribal Force is due out this summer. I'm Megan Kamrick.
Public art is something you may find on a street corner or in a park. But what makes it public? Some San Antonio citizens are finding out as they help plan a big piece of public art, an Árbol de la Vida, that will be installed on one of the city's most historic sites. On a sunny, humid April weekend, a group of about 40 community members gathers at Blue Star Contemporary, a San Antonio contemporary art space along the river. Artist Margarita Cabrera asked them here to share stories of San Antonio, its missions, and its ranches. This story gathering session, or charla, is the third of four that Cabrera has held. She wants to gather 300 stories from 300 people and make 300 individual sculptures that will be part of a giant tree of life, an Árbol de la Vida, that will serve as an artistic gateway to the Mission San Francisco de la Espada, established along the San Antonio River in 1731.
This is going to be an iconic piece for the city of San Antonio.
Cabrera frequently involves the community in the conceptualization and creation of her works, and the individual clay sculptures that will make up the Árbol de la Vida will be nestled in the branches of this larger 40-foot-tall, 70-foot-wide tree.
It's going to be able to be seen from the highway. If you're standing in the missions, you're going to see it from the missions.
The Alamo is San Antonio's most famous mission, but it's only one of five missions along the San Antonio River. The San Antonio River Authority, the governing body that manages the river, has asked the San Antonio River Foundation to come up with a master plan for the Mission Reach stretch of the river. Part of that master plan involves erecting large public art portals along the river at each of those missions. Here's Robert Ammerman, executive director of the San Antonio River Foundation.
So the master plan said, let's lay out what they called portals, public art instances, nodes that were along the river that then allowed people to pause for just a moment. Like if you could just get them to stop for just a second off of their bicycle or their hike, we can redirect them. We can say, did you know that there's this amazing resource, you know, within 100 yards of where you're standing?
The people at today's charla were seated in numerous intimate circles of 7 to 8 people, and they passed around a tape recorder as they each shared their stories. In one circle, stories were told about the million-year-old fossils inside the limestone that's associated with San Antonio's missions and modern-day architecture. And another shared a story of riding a bike to the mission school decades ago. And local architect Matt Wallace shared a story about some broken cascarones he found on his welcome mat. If you're not familiar with cascarones, they're empty eggshells filled with confetti that are typically cracked over an unsuspecting person's head at Easter or during the San Antonio festival known as Fiesta.
And this was not Fiesta.
Some weeks after Wallace swept up the mess, he and his wife received a letter in the mail with three pictures attached.
The first photograph was of a woman parked in front of our house with the cascarones on her lap, pouring something into each one. The second photograph was of her throwing it at our door. And the third one was a photo of our welcome mat after she had done what she did. And the letter said, "My aunt used to live at your house. My aunt passed away 6 months ago, and she was cremated. And it wasn't till a month or two ago that she came to me in a dream and said, I would like to rest again at the houses where I lived, I once lived."
Margarita Cabrera is going to gather these stories and, with the help of an advisory committee of historians, artists, and scholars, will find a way to physically embody them into sculptures.
In this particular event today, we discussed the idea of creating a book. We're also thinking about creating fossils that actually exist on the facade of San Francisco de la Espada.
And one, of course, shaped like a cascarón. Árbol de la Vida is expected to be dedicated in spring 2018. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.